Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of The Money Seat, the show where I, the host, put myself on the hot seat, bring on guests and ask me 5 questions related to money, finance, the market, and they have not sent me these questions beforehand, so I'm hearing them in live time just like you are, and I'm very excited for my next guest today. His name is Will, and I'd love for you, Will, to tell the audience a little bit about yourself.
Sure, happy to, Ross, and thanks for having me. So my name is Will Lockridge. I'm 31, almost 32, currently in a relationship, but not yet married. I'm originally from the Chicago suburbs, knew Ross in high school, did my undergrad work at SMU in Dallas, where I was a finance major. And I would say that I have a decent acumen in finance, having studied that in school and worked in the industry for several years after graduation. So I worked at Deloitte in business valuation for a couple years. I worked at a hedge fund called Millennium for a little over 5 years, where I was a stock analyst. And I'm currently pursuing my MBA in Chicago and working for a boat manufacturer called Brunswick in a corporate strategy role, which I recently started last month. So excited for the new change and happy to be here as your guest today.
Yeah, so sounds like you're, you know, it's funny because I know you're in finance and I am, and I had someone else on here who was in finance, but you're really on the technical side of finance, correct?
That's right. Yeah, very company specific investments is what I was doing. Familiar with the different techniques and methods you'd use to value businesses. So that continues to be a hobby. You know, I still invest in my spare time. It's a big hobby of mine to follow the market and invest in individual stocks.
Yeah. Yeah. You guys end up being terrible clients for people like me because you're DIYers, right? You don't, you know a lot, you do all this stuff. Yeah. It's actually funny. But at the same time, it's always good conversations to have because we could always kind of relate to that stuff. So that's good. Yeah. Thanks for the introduction and good luck with the MBA. And let's start with question number 1, if you got that ready for me.
Perfect. So the first question is, the market right now is at all-time highs. Mm-hmm. I think as of yesterday, the S&P made a new all-time high. My question is now a good time to invest any of the savings that I have in cash, or should I wait for a better entry point?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And I always get those questions from the, you know, technical analyst sides who are always trying to gain a little bit of an edge on the market. And I'm sure I don't have to tell you this, but it's never a great idea with the market to try to get too tricky, right? Or try to outsmart it, because as you know, no one's smarter than the market, even in a short-term period. But I'll ask you a few follow-ups because the answer to that question depends. And it really depends on your time frame and what you want to do. So for instance, Will, are you looking to put money in the market and have it grow over the next 10 or 20 years? Or are you looking to make some quick money over the next, you know, few months? And actually, I'm going to open that to you. And I don't know if you've thought about that or not, but let me know what your thoughts are.
I consider myself to be more of a long-term investor.
Okay.
I do manage a brokerage account on my own and, you know, buy individual stocks and have a price target in my head. And when it reaches that price target, I'll sell, but I reinvest it into something like, you know, an S&P 500 index fund.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
I do have a very long-term view, and you know, aside from individual stocks where they might be, you know, valuation gets a little rich, then I rotate into something else.
Okay.
But generally speaking, I'm not looking to take money out of the brokerage account and allocate it elsewhere.
Yeah. And so thank you. That helps a lot. My second and last follow-up question to that is, Is this money that you are, that you think you're going to need at all, or is this really money that you have extra saved that if anything happened, you wouldn't have to access it?
More the latter.
Okay. Okay. So given that, and in that situation, my answer is always going to be the best time to invest in the market is now. Always now. And the reason why, Will, is that, yes, we're at all-time highs, and we're probably going to continue to be at all-time highs forever, if that makes sense. And I can't tell you, and neither could you, right, what the market's going to look like on Monday when it opens, or in a month, or even at the end of the year, or even at the end of, you know, a few years. But Will, I bet my life that in 10 years from now, the market will be higher. And in 20 years from now, I would bet my dog's life, everyone's life, everyone I know, right? So it's okay to risk my life, but other people's not cool. But 20 years from now, I'd risk everyone I know, including yours, that the market will be up in 20 years. And that's why, because I want you to have, yes, I know it's crazy and I know it's volatile and I couldn't tell you which stocks will be up. But I can tell you overall, you know, the S&P 500 and the Dow and the NASDAQ, those major indexes will be up. And so that's why I always say the best time to invest is now. The additional factor in that too is, as you know, a major aspect of your gains and earnings in the market isn't the growth necessarily, but it's also the dividends, right? So keep in mind, even if the market was flat for the rest of the year, you should be earning, I don't know, 3-5%, right, on dividends based on what you're investing into. So you'd be missing out on that by waiting. Most people who ask me that question sit and they wait and they wait. And people ask me the same questions at the end of 2018 and 19, and they missed out on, you know, 20, 30, 40% gains. I'm not saying that's going to happen in the future because we don't know, but the waiting game is always bad for a long-term investor. You never win. Once again, in that scenario where you're talking about, yeah, do it. And once again, it might suck. You might see a huge hit, you know, in a year or 2 years from now. But in 20 years, if the market is down and you've lost money from it, then you could, you know, come find me and I'll eat my words in 20 years. Okay, Will? Yeah. So hopefully that answers that question for you. Perfect. Let's roll to question two.
Okay, question two.
Yeah.
Do you think investors, someone like me with a long-term investment time horizon, should allocate any portion of their portfolio to cryptocurrency?
People have asked about that on the show, so I'm going to tackle it in a way that I haven't covered yet. And the answer to that is, back to my first question I asked you, do you need the money now? And is it, right, a short-term thing? And if the answer is no to those, there's nothing wrong with allocating a 3-5% of your portfolio to that. Cryptocurrency, alternative investments, commodities, right? You know, private equities, REITs, stuff like that. Nothing wrong with that small concentration, understanding that they have a risk, but if it, you know, it's not going to tank your portfolio 3-5%. However, I do encourage people to do it more on a broader fund scale. So try to find some cryptocurrency funds rather than an individual cryptocurrency. I think it's still more gambling and trading than investing, just because there's not enough historical data to back up the longevity of this stuff. So sure. I would say, yeah, do your research. You know, you're a smart guy, so it sounds like you would enjoy doing the research on this, to be honest. Find a fund, find an ETF that does some, you know, cryptocurrency, you know, has like 10 or 20 of the stocks in there, or maybe the blockchain technology that drives cryptocurrency. They also have funds as well that do that. And take the 3-5% and make that a part of your portfolio if you're comfortable with it. Absolutely. I think there's nothing wrong with that. In your portfolio, because it's not fully market correlated. It, you know, it moves a little bit differently. So it's also acts as, right, you don't want to have 100% correlation in your portfolio. And for those who don't know that, a correlation just means they act in sync with the other. So you want your portfolio, you want to have different investments that, you know, act and move differently in different times of markets. So it's not all up or all down. You want to have a more smooth ride. So, and obviously I know you will know what that means. So hopefully that helps. Have you done any I'm going to ask you if you've done any cryptocurrency investing.
Very small amount. Okay. I bought some Bitcoin on January 1st.
Okay.
And, you know, thankfully it's up since then, but like you said, it's very volatile.
Yes.
And, you know, it's kind of makes you nervous when mm-hmm. you see something go up 20% yep. one month. You wonder if you should be selling and
right.
gains.
And actually, I'm glad you brought that up because a lot of that stuff is based on risk appetite. And so if you're in an investment that's going up and down that much and you can't handle it or you're worried about buying or selling, then it's probably not the right investment for you, right? Investments like that shouldn't keep you up at night. So either one, you have too much money in it, or two, it's just not the right thing for you. Whether or not it makes money doesn't necessarily mean it's right. So it might sure. not be the right for you, even if you only have $100 in it. It just, you know, I can't. And once again, maybe you just have too much in it and that's the issue. But for the most part, not everyone can handle the roller coaster rides of different things. And once again, that might be it, Will. I mean, to be honest, try it again in an ETF and maybe it's smoother, but it just might not be right for you. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, that's fair.
Perfect. Question three?
Yeah, question three. So I've allocated a significant portion of my savings into a brokerage account.
Okay.
Do you have any suggestions for saving on taxes?
Yeah.
As this is not a 401k right. or an IRA account?
I do actually. And I'm glad you asked that. That's part of, and I'll have to shamelessly plug myself here, but that's part of what I do for people actually. And part of my model is I do work with some DIYers who don't necessarily need me to manage their investments or, you know, pick stocks for them because they have the skills to do that, but they need some help on the bigger picture stuff. So maybe they do like a one-time consultant fee or a monthly fee and I help them with the tax side of things because, as you know, man, those taxes really eat in your earnings, don't they? Year after year after year in those accounts. And it becomes huge. So part of it is choosing the right things in your brokerage account versus your 401k or your retirement account portfolio. So I have some clients who, if you looked at just a brokerage or just a 401k or IRA, it wouldn't make sense unless you looked at their whole portfolio in a big picture. And by that, I mean, are high dividend paying stocks a good thing in a brokerage account? No, they're not. They're better in IRAs. So
right.
brokerage accounts are better for the tech funds, for the small cap companies, for things that are going to have a higher growth potential, but stuff that you could hold on to and wait. And instead of paying dividends and short-term capital gains, you end up paying long-term capital gains and strategically sell them right during years that you're making less income or you retire or something as well. So I think in those types of accounts, the brokerage accounts, it's better to have lower yielding stocks, more aggressive, more tech, throw in some high yield munis as well in there. You know, you being in the state of Illinois, you're not going to get a state tax benefit because I wouldn't recommend getting Illinois bonds. But if you're in a state like New York or Pennsylvania or California that has better state bonds, you can get state tax breaks as well on those. And you do that, you throw that in the tech, and then in your 401k, your retirement, maybe you get your more traditional, you know, dividend paying funds or ETFs, you know, large cap growth, blue chip stuff in those funds. And then overall, you're allocated correctly. But there's no perfect way around it, Will, to be honest. Also, there's, you know, I don't know, do you do any tax loss harvesting at the end of the year?
I have before, you know, sell something at a loss for the tax credit.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like I said, I tend to take a longer term view. And, you know, the problem is if I own a stock for 5 years and then want to sell it, it's likely at a gain and I'm
yes.
paying tax.
Yeah.
It's a longer capital gain as opposed to a shorter term.
Right. Which isn't terrible. Right now, most people are in the 0 or 15% long-term capital gains bracket anyways. So I know 15% isn't great, but to have to pay it one time off of your earnings is probably just the best way to go. But for tax loss harvesting, there's actually a little bit more complexity to it, and if you do ETFs, it's less important. But if you do mutual funds, they usually end up paying out their capital gains around December-ish, November. And sometimes you want to look to see if your mutual funds are going to pay out a capital gain, and then you sell out of them before that happens, and then buy into a similarly, you know, at a different company or a different type of fund that has similar holdings but isn't going to pay a capital gain, and then you reallocate it. It's like a strategic reallocation. Yep. And once again, you know, when I was working as an assistant before for an advisor who had lots of, you know, six and seven figure brokerage accounts, that's actually very important. Depending on the size of your account, it might end up only being a few hundred bucks. But those are things you want to look at. Usually, if you have a mutual fund, you can go on the website, and this is for everyone, and you can see what the capital gains will be as a percentage and when it'll be paid, and you can strategically buy or sell. And once again, if that's not something you want to do or know, you know, that's where I'm here. I'm the professional, and there's other people like me as well. But that's another thing you can do. But I would kind of sum it up with your question saying brokerage accounts require more maintenance, more tender love and care, right? More looking and transactions, and a little bit more strategic investing based on exactly what you're saying, especially if you're in a higher tax bracket. Once again, yeah, earning 10% in the market's great, but if, you know, 4 or 5% is going to fees and taxes and everything, then, you know, then I'm sure that's frustrating for you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that answer.
Yeah, that would be it. Just so you know, for a time frame, we always did this around October-ish, early November is when we target the tax loss and all that looking and stuff. So to give you an idea of when you do that. But hopefully that helps.
Yeah, it does. All right, question number four.
Yeah, question four.
What do you view as the biggest risks young people face if they do not work with a professional CFP like yourself?
Thank you. That was a nice plug. I did not put Will up to that. So I think there's a lot of risks that people face, because even if you're a smart guy like yourself and you have a lot of knowledge of the market and you can do investing on yourself, there's still a lot of pitfalls that young people do. Besides that, one of the biggest things is not setting up a budget and understanding their cash flow situation and saving strategy. So basically, even though you're a person, you need to treat yourself like a business, right? At the beginning of the year, a business needs to know how much they're making, how much they're spending, and have a general idea of their budget. And you as a person have to do the same thing too. Because if you don't, most of the time you're just kind of throwing money at things and hoping it works out. And a lot of times people figure this out too late in life, right? They're in their 40s or in their 50s and they're like, oh man, I got to start figuring this out now, or I have to start building some wealth now, when they could have been doing that 20 years earlier. And as you know, it's all about the compounding interest and growing your money over time. And every year you start earlier and you can save a little bit and have a budget and make sure it's going in the right place, the less you have to save over the time, the more wealth you'll accumulate, the more money you'll have, the earlier you can retire, you know, all those, for the most part, pretty powerful things. So most people, because they didn't learn this at school, learn it the hard way, learn it through taking out too much debt, right? Learning by talking to a friend who's like, yeah, I got, you know, six figures in my 401k. And they're like, what the hell? I don't have that. I'm way behind. Should I have started? And then they have kids and then life becomes complicated and you forget it. Right. And that's very common. There's a reason why my job exists and why what we do is so helpful, because one, you have to have the knowledge and technical skills to help. But two, you have to have the passion, and a lot of people just don't want to set up the time and do this. I was telling someone else that people spend more time planning their trip to Disney World than they do on their budget and their retirement, which is crazy. Right, and I get it, because it's more fun and enjoyable, but at the same time, what has a much more impactful thing in your life, right? Saving $100 at Disneyland, or, you know, saving thousands on your plan every year. So it's really like a necessary evil. And I hate to use that word because it's not evil, but it's something you have to do at the beginning of the year, every year, and make sure you get set up. And so many young people don't do that, and they don't understand the power of it. And maybe their parents didn't do it, or maybe it wasn't discussed in class, or they didn't learn it. And, you know, it just, it's always a snowball effect. And that's really what part of my job is, to help people. It's not just like, hey, you're coming out of college and let's start, you know, investing money with me and grow your assets. It's more about, let's manage your debt. Let's get a budget together. Let's get a savings plan going and figure out what the right thing to do, and make sure you're putting money in your 401k so you don't miss out on the free money at work, which is also a huge thing that people miss out on. And even starting it in your, you know, 20s compared to your 30s, that's a huge, it's a huge advantage. Once again, 10 years of compounding interest on a few thousand dollars is still a lot over time. You know, anyone, just look up the compounding interest. You could go on Google anything and just compound $1,000 over 50 years, and it's insane. So hopefully that helps people realize my job here is to make sure that you have money to do what you want, and you don't have to worry about this stuff. You know, let the professionals do it. You enjoy your life and know that money shouldn't be an obstacle to what you want to do.
So you're saying planning for retirement's a little more complicated than just buying a few shares of GameStop stock?
Well, yeah, planning for retirement's one of the most complicated things you can do because of all the variables, right? Because everyone thinks you just have to grow your money. Okay, if I have $5 million, I'll be fine. Or if I have $1 million or whatever this like magic number is, you'll be fine. And that's such a small variable part of it. Growing your money, I don't want to say is easy, but is the easier part. It's like climbing a mountain. Do you want to hire someone, or are you just focused on getting to the top? No, you want to get down. You don't, the goal of climbing a mountain is also not to die, right? And it's, once you get up to the top, how are we going to get back down? And it's really difficult because there's a lot of pitfalls once you retire, once you get down, as you get older. And the really tricky part is getting that money out, and getting that money out efficiently, and getting that money out so it lasts as long as possible, and putting it in the right investment products and vehicles and insurance and estate planning and all this stuff. So you, your loved ones, and your cares and your causes and your travel and all this stuff is protected and well managed. And there's just so many variables that go into that, that it's almost impossible for someone to do on their own. I mean, most financial advisors, have to use complex tools that we have at our disposal to run all those scenarios. So the average person who doesn't have all those skills, doesn't matter if you're the smartest doctor or whatever in the world, it's just a different, it's just, there's a lot of variables that go into that, you know, X, Y, Z, B, A, and C. And when the human brain tries to comprehend all those at once, one thing can go wrong and it throws off the whole equation. So yeah, it's so much harder to take out the money and worry about planning in retirement than it is to just make a bunch of money. You know, that's great. Now what, right? Now you made the money, now what? And it's like, I just take it out. And it's like, nope, not that simple. But that's a future problem, right? Well, first I want to work with people to get there. And then once you're there, the second thing is, how do we make sure you stay there, you stay retired, and you don't have to sacrifice your standard of living? And it's two very different things and very different skill sets, which I think people don't understand as well. A lot of people can do it yourself to build up the nest egg. Not a lot, but some. I know that. Not everyone needs me to get up, but almost everyone, really everyone, needs help to get down. And by that I mean to figure out how to strategically take the money. You know, I'll close out saying, I talked to someone and they're like, Ross, I really probably don't need you because I've made enough money in retirement, right? Let's say I have it. I have my $5 million. So why do I need you? I have all the money I need. And I was thinking, well, first of all, it's not that simple, because what if you spend, you know, $200,000 a year, or $500,000 a year, right? That $5 million is not that powerful if you're spending too much of it. And the percentage is considered the 4% rule, which is argued whether or not that's still legitimate, which is a topic for another time. But it's really all about that, right? someone who has $10 million is not going to be in good as good a shape if they're taking out $500,000 or $250,000 a year as someone who retired with a million and is only taking 50 grand a year. You know, it's all about the percentages of the 50, let's say 20, because they have, right? So there's just so much that goes into it. There's so many variables and so many things. And you throw in Social Security and Medicare and expenses and a kids, and you want to leave money to kids and grant, right? I could go on and on and on. And all that just requires a more personal touch. So yes, it's a lot more complicated than just putting the money in, winning $1 million on GameStop, and then just, you know, and just coasting off that.
Exactly. Good answer.
Thank you. I think so.
All right, last question I have for you.
Yeah, let's do it.
Number five. So what is your opinion on investing in actively managed funds versus passively managed funds, given differences in fees?
Yeah.
What do you recommend for long-term investors like me?
Man, that's a really good point. This used to not be as much of a debate before the financial crash of 2008, where mutual funds dominated the market, right? And you're paying maybe a load or something to get in. It could be a few percent. And then the ongoing expenses of those mutual funds are, you know, 0.5% to 1%, depending on what you're getting. But overall, you're doing well. And then now it's switched to the fact that the market's efficient. So why do I want to invest in active funds when the passive funds will be 0.5% less, let's say 0.75% less of a fee. And it's just going to mimic the market. And that's what I want to do. You know, the percentage is like 85 to 90% of the passive beat the active over time. And so on the surface, and this is why statistics can be misleading, on the surface, that would say I should absolutely do passive, right? Passive ETFs versus active, right, when 85 to 90% of them are better. However, my job and investment manager's job, so I'm going to put my investment manager hat on now, because financial advising is a little bit different than what you asked. So I'm going to go back to being now I'm an asset manager. My job is to talk to Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan and American Funds and Guggenheim, and I could go on and on and on and name a bunch of fund families, and talk to them and know what are their top performing funds, get access to them where, to be honest, you and the regular investor won't, unless you have lots of money to invest, and know which one of their funds are in that 10 or 15% that beats the active. I'm not going to lie. And I've actually found that almost all of them do a pretty good job of, one, being kind of honest with that, and two, you could do enough research and figure out which ones they are. Because these fund families, if, let's say, Will, you call them up and you call up JP Morgan or Invesco, and you're going to say, what are some good funds to invest? And they might give you one or two, but to be honest, they're going to tell you all of our funds are great, right? They want all your money to go with them. But with me, they know that we're constructing a portfolio and we have one or two funds in each asset class. And so they want us to use their strongest funds, and they're going to tell us what their strongest funds in each class are and what they do. So then we can pick the best large cap growth and the best small cap value and the best mid cap international and all that stuff. And so we're picking the 10 or 15% that are beating the active, sort of that are beating the passive. And while we're not going to do it all the time, I do have a pretty good idea, because they're in my portfolio, of what those are on a consistent basis. And so I would argue that having those is worth paying the extra fee, because there's a reason why they cost more, right? If they cost more and they didn't outperform, then no one would do that. So I have another thought on this too, is that the other reason why you're seeing passive be active so much in the last 10 or 12 years is when the market's on fire and roiling and everything's up and all-time highs. Well, that's obviously better for passive, because you could just close your eyes and throw a dart at the board and you're going to make money. But when the market's volatile, when things are crazy, when things are not going well and things are down, actively managed funds will outperform passive because they have more flexibility. They're more proactive. The top quality ones, that's where you get your money from. So if we hit a recession and we have, you know, 2 or 3 years of down market, you're going to see a lot more active do better than passive, especially in a small cap or a mid cap space. And you're going to see them considerably outperform them. And instead of it being, you know, 10 or 15, it could be 20 or 25. I couldn't tell you the exact amount. So that's why I like active more, because I want to know that if the shit hits the fan, I want to know that I have a professional person who, once again, is smarter than you and smarter than me, and they're doing this as their profession every day, which is buying and selling in stocks, and this is what they do. While I'm an investment asset manager, I don't have the access to the information that they do, and they're making strategic moves in their funds based on what's going on, to be honest, and especially in the categories that are harder, right? So if it's a large cap fund, maybe it's not a big of a deal. But if it's a European fund, or if it's a China fund, or if it's a micro cap fund where you really have to know what's going on,
right,
then I want to have the experts. I want it to be active, because those passive funds are going to get just killed. And once again, saving the 5 or 10% a year on that for me is worth paying the extra half over time. And I have a similar view with bond funds. They tend to be better with active management than passive on the bond side. So there's a lot of argument going on there, and this is just my opinion on that. But I mostly do active for that reason. It sounds like you're someone who's a passive investment guy, right?
Yeah, I am more so. And, you know, I'm open to your opinion because I haven't been investing for all that long, you know, just since post the recession. And like you said, passive has outperformed a lot.
Yes.
I think you made some good points about, you know, if you're looking for very targeted allocations to, you know, whether it's a specific country or micro cap, then I wholeheartedly agree. But you know, if you're really just looking to track the market and you know, maybe want some large cap exposure or something, then I would agree that passive's probably the better way to go about it than that.
And the answer to your question is both. You actually want to have a portfolio that has both for that reason. Once again, you want to, it's good to track the market, especially in the S&P. Most of my large cap U.S. Investments are S&P 500, you know, Vanguard or, you know, BlackRock iShare funds, because you really just want to mimic that. You don't want to outsmart the S&P 500. But then when it comes to, right, the small cap growth or something, I'm not a big index person for those, but I throw them in. So it's really a balance. I think it's good to have both in your portfolio. And I think even in the last 5 or 10 years, we haven't got an accurate look of exactly what's going to be better, because I still think we've been living in this weird, like, 10-year growth facade since 2008. So I'd really like to see how they look in a prolonged recessionary, not just economy, but also a recessionary market where we see a year or two of losses and not gains. And then I think it'll be interesting to see how the active looks versus passive, and we can judge a little bit better.
Right.
But I have a sneaking suspicion that active will do better in that scenario, which is exactly why you want to have both. Because right now your strategy is better, right? You would rather have passive in this type of market and what's happened in the last 5, 10 years. You're just saving the money on fees and earning about the same. But in the future, who knows? Who knows if this changes, if the shift changes, what happens? So I would say, throw in some active and passive and find the right spots and track them, and it'd be a good thing to do. And once again, there's not always a right or wrong answer, because you get very granular with this question. I would tell people that the bigger picture is just put the money in something and get it invested, and get it invested in the right portfolio and right risk tolerance for you, and then get to the higher level. Will's in like level 201 and 301. And so for 101, just put your money in. But for 201 and 301, you're right. How do we squeeze a little bit extra out of our earnings as well? And I'm glad you asked that, because it's important to understand the difference between both of those and the benefits of them, and know that I think there's, you know, you could get crazy with these. Like, Will, I don't know if you looked at it, but there's like, you know, you can get I have some crazy passively managed funds, you know, in your portfolio that involve like cryptocurrencies and like biotech, you know, small microcap biotech companies, and just, yeah, it's wild out there. The options are probably overwhelming.
That's right. Yeah, that's a good point. Well, thank you for your answer. That's really helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. Was that question five?
That was five, yeah.
Awesome. Well, with that, I would say thanks for joining me today, Will. I really appreciated your technical financial questions today. They were, I like to switch up the gear of the show. I think that was a lot different way to look at what we do. So thanks for coming on the show. I hope you had a good time.
I did. Thanks for having me, and appreciate all your answers. It's really, really helpful to get your perspective.
Absolutely. Once again, everyone, thanks for joining me on another episode of The Money Seat. Thanks again to my guest, Will Lockridge, and have a good day, and see everyone next time. Securities offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA SIPC. The opinions voiced in this podcast are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professionals prior to making a decision. All performance referenced is historical and is no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested into directly. Economic forecasts set forth may not develop as predicted, and there can be no guarantee that strategies promoted will be successful.